In Kansas City's Ivanhoe neighborhood, Woodland City Farm takes up about 3/4 of an acre. It's modest, but bountiful. There are dozens of different vegetables growing, and 11 chickens.
They're hot today. They're hanging out in the shade, under, burrowing in the leaves.
Neil Rudisill runs the farm, which was part of Cultivate KC's Urban Grown Tour. It's one among 30 local farms and gardens that provide food to farmers markets and restaurants throughout the community.
Right now, we do direct sales to restaurants. That's the best way to distribute the crops. I text out my restaurants on Monday. They text me back that day or Tuesday with their order. I know exactly how many pounds of each product I need. Then I harvest the 20 pounds of carrots that I know it's sold already, you know, to the Rieger. So I pull out my 20 pounds, I clean them, I put them in one tote, and I take them down to Chef Hannah, and I say, here you go, and I drop them off and I leave.
Woodland City Farm ended up selling about $10,000 worth of food, just one small example of the big deal that local sourcing of food for restaurants has become. I'm Brian Ellison. Welcome to KCUR's Central Standard, where on this Friday it's our food show, and we're taking a look at the meaning and the impact of farm-to-table dining. Our food critics will be here in a bit to help us with the table end of that conversation, but our first guests are spending some time with the farm part as well. Mickey Priolo, good morning.
Good morning.
And Rick Mullins, welcome.
Thank you.
So the two of you have together started something called Soil Collective. What is that?
Well, you know, to get into the what, you kind of have to get into the why. And what we'd agreed that we wanted to do something to help the community a long time ago. And we wanted to give back as much as we could, but also, you know, provide good food for as many people as possible. And so we got into resolving some food waste issues. Get into some composting ideas, you know, really just try to create a meaningful dialogue about food in Kansas City and how it can relate back and go full circle back to the community.
But, so how did you do that? What did you do to address those desires to be helpful to the community?
We actually ended up having to take a lot of things upon ourselves, especially in the form of food donations to homeless shelters and some shelters for women and children, but we've also just kind of had to work our way into the community, find the right people. So we kind of just took it upon ourselves, really, to start that dialogue with the people that we felt it most important to start the dialogue with. Some things obviously aren't as easy as other things to deal with. Take, for instance, the composting. There's a lot of issues with that. So that's not something that we can immediately address. It's something that we are in the process of talking with people.
Well, you got city regulations, EPA regulations, huge fines.
So let's take a step back here. Why does it matter to be doing these things? Why would you say there's a problem with food waste or composting? Why isn't that something that's already been taken care of?
Well, I think it is. I just think it's a meaningful route to go down. You know, it's a meaningful path, and I think it's a natural path. I think everything has a purpose, you know, whether it's plants or people or even trash, you know, or people or plants that were thought to be trash. You know, I think there's a purpose for everything and everybody, and we got to kind of fit the puzzle together so that we're not just tossing everything to the side and getting rid of so much stuff. We want to find something meaningful
for it. I think if you take a look at what's happening to our environment right now, that's... do we need any more excuse than that?
Yeah.
You know? I think with the composting in particular, like I said, that it's a long journey that we're trying to address. We should be putting some of this so-called trash back into the earth because that's what it's, you know, it can
sure.
be used for.
So let's talk a little bit about what Soil Collective does specifically to address this and also to provide locally sourced food for your own use or for maybe for other restaurants too. What do you do?
Well, one thing we've done specifically is capture several hundred pounds of raw food waste and giving it back to the community. What we'd like to do moving forward is capture the same food waste but be able to provide it in a packaged meal format down the road, you know, and partner up with various organizations where we can send out these meals to people that, you know, are in need, elderly people, you know, drug rehabilitation centers, things like that.
And when we say food waste, it's not food that has expired or anything like that. It's food that is not going to be used in time and things like that. So we're not just taking trash and giving it to other human trying to, you know, just eliminate the possibility of it helps from a financial standpoint for restaurants. And not only that, but, you know, it's helping your community. So take the things you're not going to use, bring them to the people that need it the most.
So you're both chefs. How common is it for chefs to be engaging with soil, with food waste, with the sourcing of food at this level?
I think now more than ever, people are doing it. I think that there's more of a focus on regional and local cuisines. It would be dishonest of me to speculate on what other chefs are doing. It's not my place. I know exactly what we're doing, but, you know, I know that a lot of the chefs in Kansas City deal with the community. I just think we need to push a little harder.
Right.
On some
you must have a response, a sense of what the response has been from your fellow chefs here in the Kansas City area.
Yeah. People love what we're doing. I mean, we're getting great response. But I think as a chef, it's such a responsible profession. You know, I mean, you're giving people sustenance, you're feeding people. You have to be aware of the things that are responsible. You have to have that insight and say, look, I want to not only just, you know, feed you, but I want to change a little bit of my surroundings and my environment as well and try to make things better.
Rick, why did you personally get into this this area?
Which area?
Well, the area of caring about sourcing food, the work of Soil Collective.
The work of Soil Collective is something that while he was in Copenhagen, we both had this crazy idea. He was in Copenhagen, I was still here, that we wanted to take a more local, more regional approach to what we're doing and try to showcase what Kansas City, the surrounding area, has available to it. So that's kind of what was the catalyst to get us into Soil Collective. And then once he got back from Copenhagen, everything kind of just took off. We were like, well, while we are trying to present local food on an honorable level, we also should be helping our community on an honorable level. So it was just kind of a random meeting of minds. We hadn't discussed it while he was out of town. We just started it somehow.
So the two of you separately sort of came to the same conclusion about what was needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely.
Mickey, was it what was that journey for you? How did you come to that place?
Oh, it was an incredible journey. Spent a little time at restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, known for hyper regional, hyper local cuisine, and definitely influenced me heavily into what I thought about those two scenarios. And you know, but I got to say, you know, before that, you know, this is something that we'd kind of discussed, and it just so happened, you know, when I came back, it just all came together, and it was a snowball effect. The whole community thing was a snowball effect. You know, just as soon as we started talking and having this discussion, immediately it was like, well, let's try to find a way to give back as much as possible as well.
So we're talking today about farm-to-table dining, which I recognize is a sort of a broad category of things. Do you feel like Kansas City is late to that party? Is this something that has been a bigger deal in other places?
No, I don't think so at all. I think there's so many restaurants that are using local ingredients. I don't think, you know, anybody is using all local ingredients or anything like that, which is fine. You know, if it's your vision to have pineapple on a plate, right. You know, so be it.
There is no locally sourced pineapple in Kansas City.
Not that I'm aware of.
All right. I'll have to put that on hold then. But I mean, is there a vision for 100% locally sourced restaurant or food in the Kansas City area?
Is there currently a vision?
Could there be? Is that a practical thing to imagine?
I think so. It's a lot of footwork. It's a lot of research. You're talking about getting rid of sugar, which obviously is something that is used in pretty much every restaurant on the planet. Well, there's no sugar that grows here, so it's all about finding substitutes.
Honey.
Yeah, honey, maple syrups, stuff like that. You just kind of got to dig, and you got to find things, and you know, that's one of the more challenging parts of the food side of what we do is trying to find substitutes, making our own vinegars, because no one makes vinegars here, you know. stuff like that, using what's around us, what's in the wild. We do a lot of foraging. You know, it's just you got to take the time. You got to go out and you got to find the items that you're looking for, or the substitutes for the items that are necessary to run a restaurant. It's a lot of work. It might cost a little bit more money on some fronts, but at the end of the day, you're representing and you're putting out something that is truly unique. It's somewhat redefining what Midwestern cuisine could be.
What else could Midwestern cuisine be? How would my diet, my palate, have to change if I wanted to truly eat locally sourced food and only that?
Well, you get used to really delicious fresh vegetables and fruits throughout the summer. You get used to a very delicious game in mm-hmm. the winter. I think, you know, all of us, you know, have grown up in the Midwest that, you know, we're eating canned vegetables, box meals, things like that, typically as you grow up. And, you know, there's not a fully defined regional element that says this is what this is. But there's a reason why so many people came to this area and settled long ago. I mean, there's a reason why there's a large population here. And I think that if we get back and we dive deep into why those reasons are, we're going to come out on top.
So where is the growing of locally sourced food happening already? We started this segment with a visit to a local urban farm. Where else are people going to get locally sourced food right now?
Everywhere. We just did fed some of the boys at Boys Grow.
Remind us what Boys Grow is. It's an urban program for that teaches kids about urban farming.
Yeah, absolutely. About farming, cooking, life, fitness, everything. It's a great organization.
It does. It deals with the business end of it as well. I mean, they mm-hmm. make a product that they sell, you know. So it's, you know, it's taking these kids and giving them something that is permanently usable. There's a lot of things that we can teach kids that are just out the door, out the window, you know, one ear out the other. And this is something really tangible, something that can be used in times of distress, times, you know, that are good, that could be used any time. So I think what they're doing out there is amazing. It was an honor to be out there.
Where else is this happening? I understand that foraging is something that that you guys have explored.
We've been known to dabble.
What is foraging? Tell us about that.
So we're just going out into the woods or anywhere that is away from highways, away from railroad tracks, that has safe soil, and we're using natural resources. We're pulling up herbs, we're finding tree nuts, we're finding berries.
Mushrooms,
the whole gamut. So basically, we just go out there, we sweat, we get cut up, but we also walk away with really good products. So really interesting things that aren't available necessarily on the market.
Can you give me a specific example of something you recently foraged?
We had some chanterelle mushrooms, which I think are better than morel mushrooms on any given day. Not to say morels aren't good, but
starting a mushroom war.
Yeah, right.
we'll be getting calls from the morel lovers.
Right. You know, and we found some black clove currants out, which is an indigenous currant to the Missouri area or to the Midwest. Gooseberries, blackberries. We found multiple huge blackberry patches, and there is a distinct difference between a wild blackberry and a blackberry that you get shipped to you via whoever your produce company is.
For anybody listening, be very careful of the thorns when foraging blackberries.
Well, and not only the thorns, but I guess I have to think, at least for private individuals who are trying to do foraging, mushrooms and berries are two things that are sometimes not so great to use in your food. Right?
Yeah, sure. And there should be a good amount of caution exercised by anyone, and they need to do research. This is something that we've dug quite deep into. But yeah, if you're going to go out and pick wild food, you need to know what it is.
Well, and I guess what this raises for me is, you know, yes, it's one thing for a family out on a day hike to pick some berries and enjoy those on their ice cream that night. But but can you, as chefs, really make a sustainable food source out of something like foraging?
Absolutely. And it needs to be done. I mean, nobody's getting to indulge in locally foraged things. You know, there's a situation, you know, you can't really have a lot of wild game in restaurants right now, at least in this area.
Can't really have any wild game in restaurants.
Yeah.
And why is
now.
That?
Well, it's wild game.
It's illegal? Or it's just too much work to get?
I don't think it's too much work to get. There's plenty of people that hunt in the Midwest. You know, you just have to go through a source that's been approved by the health department and by your state. So
do regulations need to change to make wild game more accessible, or do there
need
to be more?
There's a lot of regulations that need to change. Yeah.
Like what?
Well, they need to allow it to let it be a natural cycle. You know, let these hunters go ahead and hunt, and then bring it into restaurants and sell it. Just like, you know, on the intro, we heard a guy dropping off some vegetables for the Rieger. You know, same way for ducks or something like that. You know, I mean, that's the way it should be.
But it is.
It's not.
But it is not.
Yeah.
Besides the regulations changing, do there need to be more approved sources, more places that are butchers or farmers who go through the process of getting those certifications?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, yes. Whether that's or can become a reality is a whole other story. But whether there's a willingness for people to do it, too.
Soil Collective that you've started is operating as a nonprofit, right?
It's not operating as anything.
It's not operating as anything, but you see this
group.
But this is as work on the side of your. You have other jobs.
Oh yeah,
surely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you fund this work? Is there anything? Is there a cost right now? And where do you hope it to become?
Well, it's all funded through the dinners that we do. And so, I mean, there's a small margin there, but that allows us to continue research, buy more literature, buy more books about wild mushrooms and foraging and things like that, and continue the process.
Tell me about these dinners.
Okay. We do one about once a month, and it's all local ingredients. It's a collective of about 15, 16 chefs. We all come together, put out lots of courses. It's all seasonal. It's all, you know, right place, right time. And we try to have fun. It's like a dinner party. It's like, you know, being in my living room or something. You know?
If I go to a restaurant seeking locally sourced food, I mean, that's something that I see on menus and chalkboards from time to time. Should I trust that? It seems like there's been news stories around the country of investigations that show that places that say the food is locally sourced may or may not always actually be.
I can't tell you whether to or not to trust the chalkboard. I just really, really hope that anyone who has the guts to put up that that's what they're doing is really what they're doing. To be dishonest to the people who are eating your food is to be dishonest to yourself.
There's really no way I would know, is there?
There really isn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you both. We're going to ask our food critics to weigh in just a moment about their choices for local farm-to-table options. But let me ask you, other than restaurants that you're personally involved in, are there a couple that you think are doing this really well in town?
Novel.
Novel? There's,
I mean, but with the exception of the seafood, I know he receives a lot of local proteins, produce. And so I know Ryan's been on there. Justice.
Mm-hmm. Justice Drugstore up in
absolutely.
Smithville.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. He's, I think, certainly highly, highly concentrated on that.
How about you, Mickey?
Oh, I'd agree with both of those. I like what the Rieger does a lot as well. I think that's what they're doing is excellent.
Well, very good. Well, that's Mickey Priolo and also Rick Mullins of Soil Collective. Thanks, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, the food critics will join us as we continue this conversation about farm to table. Where do you go for great locally sourced food in Kansas City? We want to hear about it. Give us a call at 816-235-2888 or tweet at KCURCST. I'm Brian Ellison, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. It's Friday, and it's a food show on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, and joining me are the food critics, Charles Ferruza with The Pitch. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning.
And Jenny Vergara with Feast Magazine. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning.
And Jill Silva of the Kansas City Star. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
It's good to see all of you. Later in the show, it'll be time to check out what's new and noteworthy in Kansas City dining. But first, we're talking about farm-to-table dining in Kansas City. And Jill, I asked our guests in the first segment if Kansas City was a little late to the farm-to-table party. What do you think?
Well, we've really been doing farm-to-table for a long time, but I think that it's really hit the mainstream probably in the last 4 years when we look at the White House and we see what Michelle Obama was excited about and putting in a garden at the White House. So It's always been going on, but I think it hit that mainstream fervor and people started to understand the term farm to table.
Mm-hmm. Jenny, have you seen the environment change for farm to table dining in Kansas City?
You know, I think there's a certain percentage of chefs who have always been cognizant and farm to table has been important to them. I think there's other restaurants that have jumped onto the name and used the name in spirit, farm to table. So unfortunately, I think it's getting a little diluted right now. But as long as we still have people who still, you know, farm to table is something that you can do at home as well. That's the other thing to remember. It's not just chef driven or restaurant driven. It can be something you do at home as well.
And the farm could be your garden.
Absolutely. Or the farmer's market.
So which brings me, I guess, to the question of this name that you're talking about. Charles, one of the real questions I think people ask is, what does that even mean, farm to table?
Well, I think it's a marketing ploy. I mean, I think it's way overblown and or has become way overblown. And it certainly sounds fresh and interesting. And, you know, I think it gives people the impression, not always correct, that before a chef, you know, opens the doors to his restaurant, he's, you know, he's at one of the farmers markets buying the freshest, crispest produce. And, mm-hmm. You know, and you know, believe it or not, you know, I think there are restaurants in Kansas City that have, you know, been farm to market for a long, long time. You know, not everybody wants to open a can of green beans.
Right, right. And I guess I would say I almost expect that there's some level of attention to the sourcing of the food at a finer restaurant, even if I didn't see it on the blackboard that said it was farm to table.
Well, I mean, it's not like, you know, a restaurant owner is running to Price Chopper every 5 minutes.
Well, I think the important part is that this is something that the chefs have had to cultivate with the farmers. The farmers, you know, the farmers are interested in working with the chefs and bringing their produce to them. But the chefs had no way of, you know, think of all the time. A lot of chefs in town had to create their own sourcing networks and their own channels and their own relationships with the farms to bring this stuff in. So this has been a process to figure out how to get farmers and chefs kind of working together to get the product coming in the back door of the restaurant.
It's interesting you would say there was a time. Does that imply then that that isn't really the case anymore, that you can run a restaurant without developing that kind of network if you don't work at it?
Well, you can always call the Sigma truck, I guess, and right. have it pull up. But, you know, I mean, the chefs are really the ones who care about local ingredients and want to use local ingredients and local farms. They have to go and create those relationships with those farmers and basically change their menus on the fly. They have to have that flexibility and be willing to do that work in order to have those ingredients on the plate. So,
you know, when you came up with this theme, Brian, I was thinking that you know, in the glory days of the Fred Harvey restaurants and the ones at Union Station, they always had the freshest food, the freshest fish, the choicest beef. And, you know, they could do it because of their relationship with the railroads.
Right.
But, you know, and also at the flip side of that equation is that going out to eat in the early part of the last century was expensive. So people didn't want what they could, you know, grow in their own gardens. Mm-hmm. They wanted, you know, they wanted nice, delicious things, but it had to be, there was an economic component to that.
Right. I mean, I guess that is the question, is that farm to table has become perhaps an expectation, certainly something that is attractive, but you know, I do sometimes want really good fresh seafood that I know is not locally grown.
Right. Well, you know, and very few chefs can do 100% local food, farm to table in Kansas City area because of obviously in wintertime we don't have those things. Also, who wants to give up sugar and lemons and, you know, things that we've traded
pineapples,
coffee, things we've traded for centuries. But I think the gist of this whole question has become people are very interested in where does my food come from? And the chefs just happen to be leaders sort of against a place we'd gone, which was very processed food. And, you know, in our rush to convenience, we want to be able to just get online and order our stuff and have it show up at the back of the restaurant and, you know, prep it out. And I think people started to understand there are some political, social, environmental, and health reasons to reexamine what's going on with our food system. And like I said, chefs are often the leader in that. So when you start looking at menus back in the late 1990s, I was going to restaurants and seeing farmers' names on the menu. It's like, well, that's interesting. Who are these people and what's their story? And I think we've come to a time, to what Jenny's saying, that we don't need to do that quite as much because it's more mainstream and people tend to have an image of what farm to table might be about. But it's pretty complex, yeah. And there's still a lot more to learn about
it. It's not as exotic as it once was. Yeah, Charles?
I was going to say that, you know, we live in a time, it's certainly a novelty to me that chefs have become celebrities, at least over the last 30 years or so, because, you know, as someone who grew up in the restaurant business, you know, a chef could, you know, come from a cordon bleu background or, you know, be a bum. Mm-hmm. I had worked with more of the latter. And but now that chefs are celebrities or have become celebrities, you know, the other people in the restaurant process, and Jill, I want you to tell me what good agricultural processes mean. It's on your list, because I'm not sure I know. But the other, you know, the celebrity thing is going down the line where I expect to open a menu and find out not only, you know, the name of the farm where the vegetables or whatever come from, but like the farmer's children,
right,
ex-wives, you know, it's
how the chickens were fed,
exactly,
what fertilizer was used in the garden.
You know, it's all part of the celebrity culture.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, let's figure out where in Kansas City this is happening and where it's going well. We want our listeners to be part of that. So don't forget to call us and join our food critics in identifying your favorites. What farm-to-table or locally sourced dish has caught your attention lately? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCURCST. Jill, let me start with you. Where do you go in Kansas City for the best in farm-to-table food?
Well, there are several restaurants that are really dedicated to that concept. And then there are many others that are doing very nice food, often much of it locally produced.
Let's start with the ones that are like totally dedicated to this idea.
Yeah. So one of the first ones was Bluebird Bistro. They had a garden out front. They really started a system and a network of how to contact farmers. Farmers on that flip side sort of said, oh, I've got a new market here if I can figure out how to do this. There were a number of different people doing this for a number of years. Kevin Malore, who no longer does it. There was another man, Dan Marino, who was kind of known as the guy that was delivering to chefs. And it was a really interesting concept to have a farmer deliver directly to a chef.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, that's not such an interesting...
You mean Mark Marino?
Mark, sorry. Thank you.
I kept thinking...
Dan Marino's
a football
quarterback.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
And so from there, we get Jonathan Justice doing Justice Drugstore. You know, he's probably the most local person out there. But also Michael Faust, trying to do, I talked to him this past week, you know, he thinks he's probably around 80 to 90% local food. So we see a growth. Now we're also seeing chain restaurants start to be interested in picking up maybe great tomatoes when they're available. The only problem with that, in some cities, those chain restaurants are appropriating something that they're maybe not actually doing. And there was a big report recently in Tampa that is indeed happening. I don't think that's happening here. But obviously, as you get more people in the mix, there's also a marketing opportunity.
Well, right. I don't want to get away from the restaurants, but the article you mentioned out of the Tampa Bay Times, if I'm remembering the name of the newspaper right, there was another one in New York City last week even about whether Kobe beef that says it's Kobe beef is what it is. The honesty in the menu issue is still a very real one.
Absolutely, and I think you see that in issues of grocery shopping and farmers markets as well. You know, you really need to ask your farmer if, you know, they're growing it locally, or maybe they're buying through a distributor who's bought from somebody in another state. There's still so many questions to ask because a lot of these processes aren't well regulated, and it's really easy to tell a beautiful story of a bucolic farm with a red barn and happy cows. You know?
But those burgers just came off a truck, really.
It's possible. So, you know, you don't want to be duped in this. There's some room for that.
Jenny Vergara, mm-hmm. Where do you go for good locally sourced food in the area?
Oh, gosh. So I'm going to give a shout out to Room 39. I think Ted Havinger was one of the first people that I ever saw putting farmers' names actually on the menu, both in terms of his produce and in terms of cheeses and eggs and meat. And they've actually – he's launched out at his Leawood location a new thing called the Second Helping Supper Club, which basically features a different chef the second Monday of every month. And for $39, it's a three-course meal. And it's basically built around his relationships that he's built with these farmers. And I was lucky enough to go to the first one, and it featured Crumb heirloom tomatoes, which are just fantastic tomatoes. You'll find them on a lot of menus around town. But, you know, I think Room 39 at both locations really has, Ted has always had a real dedication to working with farmers and having that kind of, those kinds of dishes on his menu.
How about you, Charles? What's a good place you'd go for this?
For farm to table?
Yes.
Where they kind of take it seriously. One, of course, is, you know, Renee Kelly's Harvest, which I think is on all of our lists. She's a real devotee.
Out on Johnson Drive. What makes that such a unique choice?
Well, for one thing, I think she is a very thoughtful and talented chef who really utilizes whatever is in season in a very artful way. I like the new Plate restaurant. And although it's almost impossible to get a reservation.
In Brookside East?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, East Brookside, Ebro, or whatever they're calling it now.
I'm not going to use that ever. Yeah.
Nor will I.
But what is, tell me more about Plate. What's special about it? It
may be the noisiest restaurant in Kansas City. It's certainly one of the smallest. And two very adorable owners the kitchen... And forgive me, I can't remember what the name of the chef is, but I should. Everything is locally sourced, and it is not of an elaborate menu, especially, but it's a good menu and a solid menu, and they take local vegetables and local purveyors of whatever very seriously. I mean, they have a lot of stuff from Powell Gardens, and I think that's kind of impressive.
Yeah, Powell Gardens actually is supplying their Heartland Garden, I think is what they're calling it.
I think they're supplying, yeah.
Quite a few restaurants.
Quite a few. Mm-hmm.
Our guests in the first segment from Soil Collective, I think a lot of their dinners are actually out at Powell Gardens, mm-hmm. Which I would not have thought of as a food source from my visits to
An awesome food source. One of the first really long, where they have those really long tables and everybody sits together, one of those first farm-to-table type dinners happened out there a number of years ago with Jonathan Justice and the national organization that started that sort of visiting supper club. And they would plop down in Fields, and they decided to plop down in Powell Gardens a number of years ago. And that concept has continued also to be, I think, identified with farm to table. It's a way of getting out into the farm, so to speak. So that's...
Yeah, farm dinners are incredible. I mean, there's an incredible amount of farm dinners and more happening all the time. I mean, I think this is really something the Green Dirt Farm Dinners, the Soil Collective guys that were on earlier, Boys Grow are doing their own farm-to-table dinner. I mean, it's a way to really connect the food with the chef kind of out in a beautiful setting.
Well, can I ask, Brian, something that Jill brought up in her list, which is... Sheridan's Unforked, which is my favorite. I don't even want to call it fast food, but it's a burger joint, really, essentially.
It's definitely fast casual, almost. Well, they have a drive-thru.
Right.
I think we can call them maybe fast food.
Why are there not more of those? I thought they were going to be a chain.
Yeah, you may need to tell those of us who don't live near one of these these Sheridans what's going on there.
So it's mostly sort of a taco and fast casual burgers, sandwiches, burgers, salads. They do breakfast, I believe. They fresh squeeze juices. They do have a drive-through, and I actually got roasted corn on the cob in the drive-through, which was kind of interesting.
Did you eat it in the car?
I took it home. That was too dangerous.
It doesn't work for me at all.
Don't eat it in the car. But so here you are getting produce like right out of the drive-through window. Brilliant, you know. And I know that they very much try to source locally and regionally, and I think they have a great kale salad, different things like that. So people are eating healthy, but I don't know that they're...
because I love it. I love it. Yeah. But you know what? If I'm craving a hamburger or a taco, I'm not driving to 119th Street to get it.
Well, you're going to need more of those. And I think it's a model for what could be really delicious, really healthy food out there in the fast food sort of conveyance.
Where do you go for locally sourced delicious food? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's what Jeannie in Belton did. Jeannie, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just want to say, first of all, that I am a farmer, but I'm in agritourism, but I do know what a good tomato tastes like. And so I'm super picky. And I have a friend that just opened up a restaurant in the West Bottoms called the West Bottoms Kitchen. And he makes, first of all, he starts his BLT sandwich with a Sally Nunn bread he makes himself. It's after this English recipe, and it is just so good. But he makes a BLFGT.
Okay. I'm trying to guess what those other ingredients are.
Anybody get it yet?
Fried green tomatoes.
There you go. So,
very good.
You know, in certain times of the year, the green tomatoes.
Are those all locally sourced items, Jean?
Yep. Yes, he does. He goes out to the farmers markets, and he's tied into the Sayo West Garden and a couple other gardens in Ivanhoe neighborhood, which has a lot of good produce. In fact, you spoke with Neil earlier. His name is Jim Hamilton, and he opened up just a couple months ago. But
great.
That sandwich is to die for.
That's a great suggestion, Jeannie. Thank you so much for the call. Are there any other restaurants that our critics would say people don't want to miss if the farm-to-table dining is their thing, or even particular dishes that stand out to you?
Story.
What about Story?
Great chef owner, really serious about fresh produce, locally and regionally sourced. He's the Michelangelo of suburban restaurant owners.
It's a very good restaurant.
Yeah.
One of my favorites.
Comes up from time to time in a lot of different categories in this program. Any others for you, Jill?
Well, I would throw in there, if you're not, looking for a sit-down dinner, that you might try the Sundry or Howard's Grocery. Those are more grocery-oriented, although they do have food, and they are making a very serious move into local food. Also, I think we can also talk about proteins, and local pig, mm-hmm. Is another that very much works with farmers in order to have the best quality meat and game that you can have. So those are all good places, not necessarily fancy, not necessarily sit down, not necessarily even talking a lot about that, but
yeah,
that's the basis of their business.
And Jenny, if folks are willing to make a road trip, is there anywhere you'd suggest they try?
There's actually two places. One of them would be the new Green Dirt Farm Creamery, and that would kind of fall underneath what Jill was talking about with Sundry and some of these others, where they're doing ice creams and sandwiches that are all locally, locally made breads, cheeses, obviously their own cheese, and then meats as well. So that's a really, really great place. But if you're willing to make a little bit more of a drive, I suggest Catalpa Restaurant, which is out in, where is it? Oh, Arrow Rock, Missouri. Chef Liz Huff is out there, and it's about an hour and 45 minutes.
Didn't she used to work here in town, Liz Huff?
No, she didn't. She didn't. I don't believe she ever has been in Kansas City, but she's got a little house kind of out in Arrow Rock. It's a historic Civil War town with a great little theater, but she is doing farm-to-table out there in a really meaningful way.
I could have sworn she was at the Majestic.
She might have been.
Well, don't forget, you can find all our critics' recommendations and our callers' recommendations, too, at our website. We'll have those up at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. We need to take a break, but when we come back, it's been an eventful few months in the Kansas City restaurant world. We'll catch up on the new and the noteworthy. I'm Brian Ellison. Food Critics and I will be right back. It's Friday, it's the Food Critics, and it's time for our quarterly look at what's new and noteworthy in local dining here on Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Three great writers, thinkers, and talkers about food are here. Charles Ferruzzo of The Pitch, Jenny Vergara of Feast, and Jill Silva of The Star also curates the Chowtown KC blog for them. Jill, it's not such new news, although we haven't had a chance to talk about it here yet. The American Restaurant announced back in June that it was closing at the end of the year. But there were also some new developments about that this week. Remind us of what happened, what the announcement was, and what the latest is.
Well, the announcement was that after 40-plus years, the American would close at the end of the year. Kind of a sad goodbye chapter. It's been a very pivotal restaurant in the Kansas City scene for just so many years, with so many of our top chefs going through there. They're going to do pop-up events, so we'll see how that plays out.
What is a pop-up event?
just sort of special events that they might bring a chef in from somewhere from around the country who would maybe cook for a week or a couple of days and do some kind of a special, you know, exciting event and then...
Okay. And then be gone.
And then be gone.
Then it closes down.
And then be gone. The American's executive chef, Michael Corvino, announced yesterday that he's going to be opening the Corvino Supper Club and Tasting Room on Walnut.
That didn't take him long to get a new gig.
So he'll be staying in town, and he has a really lovely space, and I think it's going to be a really interesting restaurant. He'll have two different spaces. One is a dining room bar, and the other is sort of a more private dining with jewel box seating. Not sure what...
Yeah. Whatever,
tasting
jewel
box.
Jewel
box.
Tasting menus, yeah. Special things.
Jenny, how big a deal is this, closing of the American?
You know, I mean, Jill's right. It's an iconic restaurant that we cannot, you know, we absolutely have to tip our hat to the American. You know, we've all kind of watched over the years and wondered what would happen. And I think Corvino really has made a tremendous impact in that restaurant. And his impact and his team cannot be... you know, can't be forgotten in this case. I think it's great that we're going to get to keep him in Kansas City.
Charles, what do you think of that pop-up concept?
Well, you know, it's sort of a...
You have a sour look on
no,
your face,
No, it's not
Charles.
Really sour, but I just don't hop on the pop-up thing. Here's what I want to add to this conversation, which is, you know, I think the American restaurant has been the greatest charitable gift that the Hall family has ever given to
Amen.
Kansas City.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the rumor has always been that the American restaurant never made any money. And it was an extremely expensive restaurant from day one. And Kansas City was really, really lucky to have it because they did introduce some really world-class chefs to Kansas City. But as Michael Corvino and I discussed yesterday when I was writing my story, which is, you know, the fine dining days of our parents' generation is gone.
Agreed.
I asked Michael, I said, well, do you think fine dining, as we know it, is over? He said, no, but it's just been reinvented.
And what's the change, Charles? What does that mean? White tablecloths and white napkins? What's changed?
Well, I'll tell you, in terms of the American, it wasn't until relatively recently, Jill can probably tell me when, but that you absolutely had to wear a jacket to eat there.
Yeah.
and there were many times I showed up without a jacket, and they conveniently had like a polyester sports coat in the back. Always, you know, when I was younger, three sizes too big. Maybe now it would have been three sizes too small. I don't know. But there was always a very, very formal serving style.
Well, service was just, you couldn't, you know.
And so when we say fine dining has changed, that's the part that's gone. That's not coming back. Is that what you're saying?
I think there's a lot of fanciful stuff going on and a lot of really expensive dining going on with lots of luxury foods, but people want to do it in a much more casual
right.
way.
That's right.
Right. I was the fine dining that I grew up experiencing, not that my parents ate in a lot of fine dining restaurants, but there was a great theatrical quality. And I would compare that kind of fine dining to opera, where now it's more like a Broadway show.
That's a very good.
Oh, thank you.
That's good. You should write professionally.
I'll think about it.
So the American is not the only development in dining in Kansas City in the past few months. Among other things, we've had some problems with some liquor licenses in Westport. Jenny, what's that about?
Yeah, you know, I actually haven't written about this, Charles. I think you have.
Oh, okay.
So he probably can speak to it a little more. But, you know, certainly we've seen Savat and Julep in Westport that recently have. And I think there was a restaurant in Lawrence, too. I had heard a rumor that
you know, I think you're right.
Somebody in Lawrence got dinged as well for having a restaurant license, but not selling enough food.
So well, Kansas City
the proportion of liquor to food.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And Kansas City historically has had complicated liquor license rules and regulations. And in this particular case, Savat and Julep, they sell a good amount of food. The problem is that they are tiny restaurants, very tiny. And there's no way, for example, that Savat and Julep, which are both in Westport, are going to sell the same amount of food that, say, the Westport Cafe, which is a larger venue.
Well, it's something like you have to sell $200,000 worth of food or 50% of your sales has to be
profits,
food.
Yeah.
So why did they not get the license that would just require them to only sell alcohol? Why would a whiskey bar like Julep or a champagne bar like Sauvage not have a license like that, instead have one that requires them to sell food?
In Westport, because of the saturation of restaurants, they could not get a tavern license. And I think that's the license you're referring to, where, you know, there would not have to be that food component.
There's already too many of those out there.
Well, in Westport, I mean, they are not issuing tavern licenses in Westport anymore, and probably won't for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that story. Do we know, do they have to sell a certain amount of food by a certain deadline to
yes,
keep their license?
Yes, both of them. And the last time I talked to Bo Williams of Julep, he said that they were already very, very close mm-hmm. to making that deadline. You know, but here's the Missouri liquor laws need to be changed, because it used to be one size fits all, and that just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, this will continue to be an issue that's going to have to be worked on for new places to develop in Westport and other places.
Worked on through like different legislation.
Yes,
probably.
through the city channels.
Well, let's talk about other new and noteworthy things happening. Jill Silva, what's standing out to you?
Well, I spent some time on the Cirque du Sucre truck recently.
You were actually on it selling?
Well,
stuff?
You know.
You're not doing acrobatics and things.
Not doing acrobatics. Watching Natasha Gellner, the pastry chef, do the acrobatics with her ice cream. So that was a lot of fun. They're just starting to get out there and do a lot of pop-ups. There we go with that word again. different events in different places. I heard they did one in Columbus Park at the ramen shop, and it was a huge success. And they did Korean-style Sunday ice cream.
Korean-style ice cream?
Is there
it's
kimchi
so
in it?
Good. No.
There was red beans and, matcha powder and
gummy bear stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
And shaved ice.
Unshaved ice.
Cream
classic
and
Korean delicacy gummy bears.
Yeah, it's just like everything in a cup that you can imagine.
Patsingbu, is that what you say it? So they'll sometimes do that. They also do very straightforward ice cream, although the flavors might not be so straightforward. I had an orange blossom. There was also popcorn and sweet potato ice cream and different kinds of waffle cones. So that was a lot of fun.
Right. Jenny, what's new and noteworthy on your list?
I want to talk about Brown and Low. That's the new restaurant that's opened up in the City Market just actually this week, I think, from Harry, who has Harry's Country Club, obviously. And, you know, it's a really beautiful space. John O'Brien did the space, and he's kind of known for doing very classic kind of old world style restaurants. And the place is just a showpiece. And the food is really good. I mean, it's reasonably priced. No, it's not too expensive. I mean, it will bank money in the City Market, I predict, because it is so appealing to everyone. I mean, there's something for everyone on that menu.
And it's on the streetcar line.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't hurt, mm-hmm. right?
Charles, what's new and noteworthy in your world?
Well, since I neglected to bring a list, which I will email you, but
I'll look forward to that.
But on Jenny's list, I have also eaten at the Oliver, mm-hmm. which is the new restaurant, well, I guess it's a few months old, in the space that had been most recently...
Republica.
And this is a much wiser concept, especially for that plaza space.
Oh, I agree. I think everybody saw that. But have you ever seen a smoother transition? I mean, it was 3 weeks in the flip and then back open, and it was like we've never...
Right, and it looks like it's been there...
It looks like it's been there the whole
decades.
Time. Yeah.
I like to go to restaurants where... Not that I'm a great chef by any means, but where I can find things that I would never think of making at home, Sloppy Joe's at the Oliver.
I love Sloppy Joe's.
I do too.
Some grilled cheese and things like that. It's a pretty good place. Well, that's our food critics for this week. Charles Ferruzza of The Pitch, Jenny Vergara of Feast, and Jill Silva of The Star. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Good to have you. So for a list of all the restaurants mentioned today, and maybe even a few they didn't get to mention, visit kcur.org/centralstandard this afternoon. You can find all our past shows there, too. Twitter is a great way to keep in touch with the show as well. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at PTS Brian. Mondays at 10 a.m., KCUR continues bringing you a variety of special programs this summer. Join us next Monday for Invisibilia. Then join Central Standard on Tuesday when Dan Verbeck comes back to KCUR to talk about a new medical treatment that may just have saved his life. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, and Fridays by Jen Chen. Our team also includes Suzanne Hogan and Andrea Tudhope, and our intern is Anna Sterla. Linda Scher is our announcer, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Gina Kaufman's on leave. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll see you next week.